Thank you all for being so orderly this morning. Usually I have to pound my gavel. But good morning. We've got a short agenda this morning, but one of the more interesting ones. So we'll start with public input, item number 16. Oh, and I wanted to introduce Molly Sherwood. She's our guest. She's our youth leader. We've created a youth initiative to try to draw young people into outdoor life, outdoor activities of any kind they might be interested in, whether it's nature appreciation, hunting, fishing, science, a career. In fact, Molly is interested in a career in natural resources. So we recruited 7 youth from around the state to help advise us on how we engage their peers in outdoor activities. So she's very kind to have joined us as a guest of the commission and one of our members for today. So welcome, Molly.
Thank you.
All right, the open public input first. And know that we have a number of people who've signed up. And I always remind people of the commission rules, which are to give each person 3 minutes. I'd like you to, when your name is called, come forward, sit at the front table. Don't need to be right up against the mic, just maybe 4 or 5 inches from the mic. And we give you 3 minutes, so when your time is up, you will hear a beeping noise, and that means we'd like you to conclude your remarks. So I try to read the writing. Looks like Jeff Hardesty. Is that right? Okay.
So good morning. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Jeff Hardesty. I'm currently a principal of a high school in Okanagan County. I've been a hunter and fisherman for an awful long time, hunting for about 25 years. Been hunting mule deer in Okanagan County for 19. I'm pretty passionate about the outdoors. I've been noticing a decline in our local mule deer herd. I realize that my decline may not reflect numbers of your population counts. This is localized. My concern about the decline in my area became realized when I took my 2 youngest boys hunting for the first time. I have property on our northern border is a canyon where there is a guide service and excessive baiting taking place. And we have witnessed firsthand anything from 15 deer being taken off of one tonnage of baiting pile of apples. Gut piles will literally scatter through the side of this bare mountain. And so because of this witness, I've begun to ask more questions of what's going on. I've gotten more active in my community, starting to network. As you can imagine, I meet with hundreds of people a month in my position. It's a very public position. The local joke is when we see 8,000 apples being shipped out, they're call apples, we know it's hunting season. People are starting to mobilize. They want to become more legislatively active. So I've broken it down to 3 things. First off, regulation. If excessive baiting is going to continue as a practice and guides are going to be pulling deer off of private and public lands, then I wonder if we should not charge them a fee, much like we do for fishing charters. This could be a revenue source for the state. Guides should be required to report harvest numbers in a said area. As far as good science, baiting in excess, as I've observed personally, holds deer in one location for extended periods of time. I believe it increases the likelihood of deer disease spread, and it basically nurtures a reliance on one single food source. And then, of course, winter hits. As far as ethics, I think the extent to which baiting is taking place is undermining the tradition and rites of passage that hunting should be honoring, especially contradicting lessons that we're teaching our youth during hunter safety courses, which are required. Even my 10-year-old and my 13-year-old children see that contradiction, and they wonder about how that is sportsmanlike. Many people are arguing that... Bummer.
Yeah. Well, you can conclude your remark.
Okay.
I like what you're saying.
Okay. I have concerns about the ethics, and people argue that it improves shot placement. So from firsthand observation, it actually just perpetuates the likelihood that a hunter doesn't practice and develop skill. And I am seeing maimed deer on a regular basis because it does increase a false sense of security of shot placement, and the hunting that I've observed is sloppy and lazy. So in conclusion, I think it's excessive from September to December. I can assure you firsthand, if you were to come to my property and see what's taking place on the side of a canyon, it's relatively grotesque. And I hope you consider this. And there is a movement legislatively, and I wonder how effective that would be. I think it really rests here. And I appreciate the opportunity very much. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Captain Anderson in the back, if you'd like to talk with him about Chris Anderson. thank you. Thomas Fritsch.
Good morning, and I appreciate this opportunity to speak to you all. And the reason I'm here, I'm
Tom
Fritsch.
Could you get a little closer to the mic?
My name's Tom Fritsch, and I'm from Goldendale, Washington, and I'm representing the American Wild Turkey Hunting Dog Association. This concerns Washington Administrative Code 232.28.342 Small Game Regulations. I want to see if we can get fall seasons, turkey seasons, to allow the use of dogs. In the United States, there's 43 states with fall seasons, and 30 of those states allow dogs during that hunting season. The dogs locate the birds and scatter the flock, allowing the hunter to set up and call the birds back in for a real sporting and fun time. They also retrieve any downed, wounded, or lost birds. They'll help you locate them. And we use dogs in every other bird hunting situation, from doves, quail, partridge, up to ducks and geese, and strangely enough, forest grouse, whose season runs the same time as the fall turkey season. So in essence, if I'm grouse hunting and come across a turkey and I have a valid turkey tag, do I take my dog back to my car and go find the turkey again? Or do I shoot the turkey and take a chance, because my dog's with me grouse hunting, being sighted? That's about the extent of my presentation. And I feel at one time, one of the commissioners, I've presented this before, asked if on a scatter, if the birds tree. And I said, well, I would imagine some probably do. And I didn't ask him his concern, but I thought later that maybe he was afraid somebody was going to shoot a bird out of a tree, which doesn't sound too sporting. But in turkey hunting, you're shooting a bird on the ground. So I don't see that there's an issue there. And if dogs were a deterrent to the turkey populations, we probably wouldn't have very many turkeys around, because the coyotes would have them all. They're probably more efficient than dogs at hunting. So I would like the commission to somehow look at this issue and see if we can change that regulation to allow dogs for the fall seasons. Can I answer any questions that anybody might have?
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that the dogs scatter the turkeys and then you go set up and call the turkey.
Yes.
Does the dog sit by you? Are you in a blind? Do you tie the dog to a tree? Or how do you, having owned a bunch of hunting dogs, I'm just interested to know how the...
Right. A well-trained turkey dog is trained to sit with you. And then on the shot, the dog's released. Yeah. Yes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Commissioner Holtzmiller.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. What would it take to make this happen?
In this Washington Administrative Code, one of the rules is that dogs are not allowed for turkey hunting. It's in the you were presented yesterday with the small game regulations. It's in there, in that WAC. So if that's changed to dogs can be used in the fall season only, or no, not during the spring season. The fall season is where this turkey hunting started. Spring seasons came way later than fall season. This is a time-honored tradition, dog hunting with turkeys throughout the United States.
Well, and to build on what you're saying, because how you hunt turkeys in the spring and the fall is totally different.
Exactly.
Absolutely different. And there again, having fought turkeys all winter off of hay piles, you know, 15 years ago in my part of the world, yeah, we were really watching out for the turkeys, but that isn't a problem anymore in any way that we can encourage turkey hunting. And what he says, I've read articles on using dogs, and no, it sounds like it'd be a lot of fun.
It is. I have a video, a DVD on it, that was produced for Benelli's Outdoor World or something, from this association, and I'm going to give that to John Weinheimer, my regional fish biologist in Region 5, who I know real well, and he will help me get it to people that can see it.
Great. Thank you.
Well, one other thing, too, in conclusion, is that the seasons, the last time I was here 2 years ago, the season had been extended from 2 weeks to 3 weeks in the fall season.
Okay. Commissioner Smith?
What kind of dogs do you use?
You can use any kind of dog. Most of the dogs are a cross of a hound and some other a scenting dog. What they like is a barking dog that chases the birds, and when the birds bust, the dog barks and stays at the spot. Then you catch up, and if you're flushing turkeys, if they all fly one direction, you can't call them back, but the dog runs and scatters them, and they usually scatter every which way, and then they call each other to come back together. So you go to the break point, set up, 45 minutes, half hour, you'll hear them start peeping, and then you start calling them back in.
I've never heard of using dogs for turkeys, so it's just kind of interesting. And you said it is common across the country?
Mostly in the eastern United States where turkey hunting originated, they thought back there when they started spring season that it was like a sin. Why would you shoot a bird that's, you know, trying to breed? Fall season was the season. You're welcome.
Commissioner Caney?
This is a question back for Jeff. So, was just thinking a little bit about this, that last year, actually in Moses Lake, Matt Marsh came down from Okanagan with the very same concern that Jeff brought in. And as I recall, we were going to, I can't remember the process of how we were going to look into that. I think the commission all agreed this is like a really big issue because you get into all kinds of issues of baiting and how it, what is and what isn't, alfalfa fields, apples. And I guess I'm just curious, maybe it's a question for Joe, as to what is the process? Were we going to include that in the three-year package? Or it seemed to me that we were going to have a further discussion of baiting, and I don't think it's been agenda put on an agenda anywhere. So just curious where we're at.
Deputy Director Storr.
Yeah, Commissioner Caney, I don't have a lot of specifics. I do remember that conversation, and I would assume that just like every three-year cycle, probably, that the baiting discussion takes place. But I'll follow up on that. And
it does, Nate is saying, it does take place for each major rule packet.
Madam Chair, we will be bringing this up as part of the three-year package.
Okay, as part of the three-year package.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Linda Saunders. please come forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners, for the opportunity to speak to you again today. My name is Linda Saunders. I'm Director of Conservation at Wolf Haven International. I'm here today to talk about the coyote derbies that are being held in our state under a contest permit issued by the department. We received many calls about the derbies after an article about the derby in Northeast Washington appeared in the Spokesman Review in the middle of February. Most callers were totally unaware that such contests have been and are being held in our state. And last year, over 400 coyotes were killed during derbies held throughout Washington. Derby organizers cite predation of deer herds as justification for the contest, but the actual effects on our deer herds by coyotes versus other predators are apparently not known. And we appreciate the department starting a study of predation on white-tailed deer in the Tri-County area to help answer this question. Thousands of coyotes have been and continue to be killed in the name of alleviating predation on wild ungulates, but best available science does not support these programs. Actually, quite the opposite is true. Coyote populations have been studied for decades by such respected scientists as Dr. Robert Crabtree from the Yellowstone Ecological Research Center, whose work was funded primarily by Wildlife Services. The research reveals that indiscriminate removal of individual coyotes may temporarily reduce predation rates on a given species, but the effect is short-term and, more importantly, has long-term side effects that can result in increased predation rates. Coyote populations compensate for population reduction. The more that are killed, the more pups are produced, the higher pup survival. The smaller pack size becomes, resulting in increases in the numbers of territories, leading to more females breeding, more pups, et cetera, et cetera. And I did include a reference for each of you, and it's a letter summarizing Dr. Crabtree's work. We understand that coyotes can be legally killed year-round anywhere in our state with no limits, with the appropriate hunting license. However, in addition to science not supporting coyote exploitation as is encouraged by hunting contests, we're concerned that encouraging more people to hunt canids for sport and potential prizes in areas of our state where wolves are now present could increase the chance that wolves could be either intentionally shot or killed by mistaken identity. We believe that permitting a derby or competitive contest where animals are killed despite what science tells us or our understanding of the effects of coyote predation on our ungulates sends the wrong message from our department to the public. Public opinion is shifting away from days where these competitions are really acceptable, and today a greater number of people, including many hunters, find killing for sport unethical, inhumane, and unacceptable. We respectfully ask the department to consider that coyote derbies could result in more incidents of mistaken identity and ask to stop issuing such permits where wolves are known to exist in our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Jim Sutton.
Good morning.
Morning.
I may fidget a little bit. Sorry, I've got a pinched nerve, so I apologize for that. Madam Chair, Commissioners, my name is Jim Sutton, and I'm here speaking on behalf of myself, but I am also the current president of the Inland Northwest Wildlife Council. And I am starting the motion to come forward to see if I can get another WAC changed in regards to using expandable broadheads. For some of you who know me, I did spearhead the light and knock issue in this state, and while doing so, was asked several times why we are not doing expandable broadheads, which are already legal in this state for using on turkey and other small game. So there are, you have a packet that will be coming to you with some information in there, a very, very good study done by a gentleman on an Air Force base back east in regards to fixed broadheads and expandables. I did take this to our board, and I'm going to read you this little letter right here, but there is an official statement from the Board of Directors of the Inland Northwest Wildlife Council. The Inland Northwest Wildlife Council Board of Directors, they have reviewed this proposal and are concerning the expandable broadheads and the facts concerning the use of archery for their use in archery in Washington State. We believe that the expandable broadheads can improve arrow shot placement and penetration, thus enhancing the archer's ability to improve their effectiveness of their shot. So, as responsible hunters, it is our ethical duty to respect the game we attempt to harvest and do our utmost to make the most accurate shot possible. To this end, expandable broadheads would aid in this, reducing less drag and more effect, like in a crosswind or something along that line, and higher energy upon impact. The council does not feel that the allowing the use of expandable broadheads would compromise fair chase, and in fact, Pope and Young does accept expandable broadheads. 47 other states allow these, and so therefore the Inland Northwest Wildlife Council fully endorses the use of expandable broadheads and urges the commission to make a change to the existing rules pertaining to the archery equipment. That is it. If you have any questions.
Any questions? Commissioner Smith.
Yes, sir, Ben.
Across the country, maybe I missed it, are these legal in most states? Or
47 states. Yeah. You will get something that shows right here of what states they're legal in, and there are a couple notes on there as to what they won't allow them to be used on. But there's only like two states that have a note on that.
Right.
Okay. And so.
Commissioner Holtzmiller?
Yes, sir.
Being the newbie, and there again, with the Luminoc deal, that one boggled my mind. Why are they against expandable broadheads?
Well, originally, I believe part of the argument was the failure rate on them, which have now pretty much, you know, they've worked that out. The failure rate on these things are so low now, it would be virtually the same as somebody placing a bad shot with a fixed broadhead. My whole point on this is you have to be ethical no matter what the commission allows, no matter what the department allows to be used. If you have a good shot placement, and honestly, I don't care whether it's with an expandable or a non-expandable, you are going to take down the deer. I'm not trying to take away from the hunting ambiance or any of that, but when that arrow is released, there's no way of getting it back. And I want to make sure that if you hit that animal, it's going to go down. I don't like seeing wasted animals, and I'm not saying anybody to any end that we are wasting them, but bad shots happen. I mean, you just heard from the other gentleman. With a slight marginal shot with an expandable, you're getting a much better rate of return, so to speak, because the chances are greater that that animal is going to expire quicker, thus you recovering that animal, as opposed to it wandering off and you never seeing it or getting it. Back to your original question. I'm sorry, I kind of got away.
Well, I think,
like
you said, the technology of the expandables is so much better.
Correct. Correct. I brought a couple samples. I was going to try and get them up here and show you guys. I mean, there's so many different styles now, you know, and it. And I said to Jay earlier, it was kind of like with the light and knock issue. The archers know. They know what work. They know it don't work. And that word spreads so fast, it is not even funny. I mean, it's like wildfire. But with the amount of requests, and looking at the some of the surveys and whatnot of the mechanicals, that's why I'm here. I'd like to see the process started. I'd like to see it in the 3-year package, let the archers of the state decide, you know, kind of what's good, what works good for us, you know. So,
well, and there again, I think you might be getting into the purist that yeah. Everybody should be using longbows and homemade arrows, but.
My rebuttal to that has been all along when I did the light and knock. You know, some of the purists, they're using rangefinders, they're using camo, they're using scent killer. If you want to get back to it, then dump it all. But I mean, things progress, things evolve. I mean, here we are.
You know, thank you.
So, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Good question.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much,
Chuck Honaker.
Uh, my interest is today is Eurasian collared doves. The reason I want to bring it up is because in the 70s, 10 pair were brought to some island south of Florida, and those 10 pair ended up growing kids in Florida, and in 30 years, they conquered the United States. The word is they may replace the passenger pigeon. Is that important? I think it is, because our mourning doves aren't doing so well. The turtle doves, if you like that word better. And I'm wondering why we don't have this added to the possession limit on doves. Season September 1st to the end of September. And I think it would be a great asset. I talked with our biologist that was here yesterday, some of those guys, they got all excited. Nobody's ever told them that before. And I go, well, I don't know why not. They're winning. Mourning doves are losing. Why don't we add them to the limit that we have, which is 10, by the way. And I don't see why we can't do that. It's supposed to be a non-migratory bird, which makes it state property. And it's also not natural. So I'm just throwing it out there for you to think about, because I think it's a good point. Might sell a few more licenses. I know in my town, Eurasian collared dove is taking it over. And the mourning doves aren't doing that well. So just wanted to make that, and I hope you heard that. Thanks.
We heard you. Thank you. Dana Del Porto?
Madam Chairman, Commissioners, thank you for this opportunity to speak. My name is Dana Del Porto. I'm a Washington native, and I currently reside in rural Quincy. I'm a retired high school art teacher, and during my 27 years of teaching, I have worked in four rural districts in the agricultural communities of Eastern Washington. I have come to speak my opinion on the wolf issue in Washington State. My position is to encourage everyone to slow down and to move ahead slowly. I am presenting you a packet that has five newspaper articles to kind of provide foundation for my comments. I have studied animals and birds for many years as a basis for my artwork. I am a citizen scientist, and I am not an expert on wildlife. I think there's four issues to me. And one is wolves in the landscape, wolves and cattle, wolves and game animals, and cattle in the landscape. The first article I reference is about the wolf people arrangement in Minnesota. The article mentions that Minnesota has the largest wolf population in the lower 48 with 3,000 wolves and 500 packs. Individual wolf, human, and domestic animal conflicts are few in Minnesota, because citizens have become accustomed to the idea of wolves in their state. The carnivore specialist who wrote the article encourages Washington residents to take the time to learn about how populations of animals and people can coexist. Interestingly, this wildlife expert states that Minnesota residents are terrified of mountain lions, whereas Washington residents have learned to coexist with mountain lions because that animal has been in our landscape for a long time. We can learn to live with wolves if we slow down and accept that this will take time and effort. The second article that I talk about is a Wenatchee, Washington article, and it reported recently on wolves being seen in that area. And The comments ranged from one rancher who viewed the wolf as just another animal on his property to a person who was calling for the removal of all wolves from Washington State, pretty much shoot them on sight. The article that also I will show you from the Missoula newspaper was a surprise because it reported an early indicator of a three-year study being done on the Montana bitterroot elk. The wolf population was suspected as the cause of the decline in elk numbers. As quoted, "Before all of this started, there were a lot of people saying that this study was really stupid. They said everybody knows the answer as to what is already killing the elk, and that was the wolf. Well, they were wrong. It wasn't wolves. It was mountain lions. Oh, dear. Okay. Well, it shows that there is a lot of research, a scientific study that needs to be done to actually find out the truth about predation issues. I had an article I'll show you about farmers in the Colville area who are doing lots of things to coexist with their cattle and wolves. And the last point I was trying to make was that the fee schedule for grazing of the 26,000 permits in the West, the grazing fees nowhere comes close to the cost of what the government spends to keep those animals on that field. My point is that if people are going to accept those low grazing fees, they should have to accept every animal that was historically on that range, and that includes wolves. I encourage you to continue your slow consideration of the wolf in our environment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That concludes the open public input. Appreciate your remarks.